Blog Talk Radio.
You know I'm proud to be black, y'all, and that's a fact, y'all. And if you try, what was born, I take it back, y'all. It's like that. Licky, 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 licky. All that people hear the serious song. It's right, not wrong. I should stay right on. I gotta tell you something that you all should know. It's not a mystery, it's history, and here's how it goes.
Marvin didn't try to be magic or charismatic and all this. He just was. Even when he sung the national anthem, I mean, it was Marvin Gaye. You know, it was just unique. It was special.
Can you see
Galilee,
yeah.
3.7838-9825 is the numbers. I don't know what happened to my man Ray Charles. Ray Charles was right next on this anthem doing the Star Spangled Banner. But then Ray. Okay, let me just tell what the show is going to be about. I guess Ray got dumped. Today's show is going to be about Megan Evers, Frederick Douglass, and news upon the Jackson family drama. Now, I ain't get tired of it, y'all. Ever since I've been going through this pro and tell how the government's been spying on black Americans and stuff like that, it's just giving me a funny feeling. So I decided to go on there and get some old Jackson news. And we're going to do about the FBI war on leaders in the 60s. So stay tuned. Be right back in a minute.
The man you're about to see and hear, should you be so foolish as to have just joined us, is Ray Charles.
Hello. All right. 3, 4. I got something, y'all, in my bones. Make me want to shout hallelujah. And I want to lift every voice and sing, till it in heaven ring with the harmony. Oh, let us sing, let us rejoice and rise high. Turn in the south as the North Sea.
Let the peace shake from the places.
Today's show is going to be about Megan Evers, Frederick Douglass, and the FBI war on black leaders. I'm trying to see what happened. I knew I uploaded it. I wonder why I didn't see it up. I'm going to try to pull that up. So let me go on ahead to the Megan Evers story. Megan Evers was a pioneer on the front lines of the civil rights movement. He's one of the forgotten heroes of the movement. You hear about Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and that's all you think of the 60s, but there was much more people in the 60s. There was H. Rap Brown, Stokely Carmichael, Huey Newton, Medgar Evers. So let's start our little tribute to Black History Month, Part 2, with the Medgar Evers story.
In 1955, the death of Emmett Till was just one more reason for Medgar Evers to continue his work as a civil rights activist. He was the NAACP's first field representative in Mississippi. Having grown up in the Jim Crow South, Medgar was a man on a mission.
There were any number of things in his childhood that really made him acutely aware of the injustices. And as a young man who volunteered to go into the army to fight for his country in World War II, and then come home and find that he was still a second-class citizen, not being able to register and vote, he said, this has to change. And he decided that he would be a part of that change.
Evers fought for change in the racially charged climate of Mississippi.
Mississippi was considered the South Africa of America. It was like the most oppressive state. The most anger and fear and hatred and violence. And so his courage in the context of that state took on bigger than life meaning.
Medgar Evers, like so many black people whose families before them were raised in the South, actually loved the South. And they had this tremendous hope that things would change.
But as Medgar worked on the front lines of change, he placed his life in jeopardy.
Just working for civil rights in Mississippi, there's a strike against you.
You're a marked person. He knew that.
Medgar and his family lived with death threats. It was a life of barricaded doors and ever-drawn window blinds and safety drills for the children.
He taught them how to fall to the floor with the sound of gunfire and crawl to the bathroom, the bathtub, and always take care of their little brother.
Despite the dangers in early 1963, Evers began an active campaign to force the issue of racial inequality in Jackson, Mississippi. He organized demonstrations, went head-to-head with the mayor and the city's business leaders.
We were determined under Medgar's leadership to forge ahead, to crack the system. And they were determined to wipe him out because he was a leader.
On May 28, 1963, the NAACP began sit-ins at Woolworth's, where blacks were not served at the lunch counter. That night, someone threw a Molotov cocktail at Evers' home. Damage was minimal, but the message was clear.
The threat, the danger, made life so precious to us. Very seldom did we ever part without saying, I love you, and certainly without embracing each other.
Prophetically, at an NAACP gathering in Jackson on June 7th, Evers told the crowd, I love my children and I love my wife, and I would die and die gladly if that would make a better life for them.
We knew. We held each other tightly a couple of nights before he was killed, and we both cried together. And he said, it's not going to be long. I said to him, I know.
On the night of June 12th, here in what was then the NAACP office, Evers watched with other movement leaders as President John F. Kennedy delivered an impassioned speech on civil rights.
We face, therefore, a moral crisis as a country and a people. We have a right to expect that the Negro community will be responsible, will uphold the law, but they have a right to expect that the law will be fair, that the Constitution will be colorblind.
Medgar was thrilled with the speech and then met with his NAACP colleagues late into the evening. When their meeting was over, he drove home. In a nearby vacant wooded lot, a sniper crouched behind some honeysuckle. Mecca's car turned into his driveway. As Mecca stepped out of his car, he slammed the door shut.
We had made a pact that whichever one of us were driving, we would never get out on the driver's side because the driver's side faced this vacant lot, and we knew that it was a wonderful place for an assassin to hide. That night he was so tired until he got out on the driver's side.
Evers was shot in the back and fell to the ground. Megger and Murley's worst fears had come true.
I ran to the front door and saw him lying there and screamed. It was only then that the children left that area and came out to join me and asked their father, "Please get up. Get up, Daddy. Get up, Daddy."
No longer a father, a husband, an activist, Megger Evers was now a part of history. Unlike the murders of so many before him, his death was not considered a lynching, but an assassination.
It was a real sign of changes to come that his body came all the way to Washington and his widow and little children went to the White House and that he was buried in Arlington Cemetery and accepted as somebody, as a martyr.
He must be looked upon as one who helped liberate and free the state of Mississippi, the South, and the nation. You know, he had many opportunities to leave, to do something else, but he decided to stay. And he paid a heavy price. He gave his life.
Medgar Evers' death served as a rallying cry for the movement. 2 months later, on August 28, 1963, a crowd of 250,000 gathered for a historic march in Washington. It was the largest demonstration for human rights that America had ever seen. Black and white, Jew, Protestant, and Catholic had come together with the hope that equality, liberty, and justice would prevail for everyone. But as for the man accused of killing Megger Evers, he wasn't even close to coming to justice.
I don't know what happened. I suppose I had a couple more minutes of that because they follow it down to the court case. Having little problems with my upload, so let me not go to commercial, but let me investigate the situation. Let me get the let me take a commercial break and I will guess I'll be right back in about two more minutes then, because I don't know what has happened to the little program that I had lined up.
One, two, one, two. Again, one, two, three, four.
We'll be right back.
Okay, all right, got the problem solved so far, so let me go on ahead and take this quick another break to upload everything. I know I'm 5 minutes early, Dorothy, but this is your little song, so let me go on ahead and knock this out the way, and that should be able to come back with what I got to do.
And now, the mellow sounds of Jimmy Irvin.
Never meant to make you cry. You were the only one I've ever loved in my life. And though it's hard for me to show it, I've got to let you know it. 'Cause darling, I love you more each day. But the words got in my way.
Can't do it no more. I can't sing no more sad songs. 1, 2, 3, hit man, pop the bop, bop it out of bebop, bop the bop, yeah, bass man, come on up. 1, 2, 3, hit man, sound good, yeah, saxophone on the floor. 1, 2, 3, hit it. Comes around for a man to be a man, take back his sign. I gotta do something to shake things. stuff. Like Johnny Mathis, but I can't do that stuff. Jimmy got soul, Jimmy got soul, Jimmy got S-O-U-L, soul. I can't do rock, I can't do roll. What I can do, baby, is show my soul. Jimmy got soul, Jimmy got soul, Jimmy got, Jimmy got, Jimmy got soul.
Righty now. Okay, I got it now. What I have to do is get rid of some of this music that I ain't ever played. So I'm sitting here deleting, you know, deleting a lot of stuff that ain't never probably ain't going to be heard no more. I'm like, man, I got all this old cuts I ain't played since day one. It's taking up all my my space. So I'm just doing a lot of deleting stuff that I know ain't going to be playing never again. And maybe that might give me some room on when I upload it. So let me see how that's looking, and I can continue on with my Mecca Evers piece. If not, I'm just going to jump into the Frederick Douglass story and then try the COINTELPRO. Now, a lot of y'all, a lot of y'all enjoyed the show yesterday when I brought to you the killers of Malcolm X. They admitted how they'd done what they was doing, and the perpetrators of the Watts riots, fires rather. And you heard how he mentioned the Black Desk. Now, everybody want to look at sellouts, infiltrators. I call it Jesse a sellout, but now I'm getting to understand this Black Desk theory, which is the agency they set up areas where I can't even pull that one up, man. Okay, I'm going to try to do all this. I might slow up on the COINTELPRO. But anyway, last show he talked about how they set a Black Desk up was the desk that they had in every city. They set up major Black organizations. They put Black organizations in every city, legitimize them and stuff like that, but the purpose of the organization is to spy, destabilize the Black community, basically monitor the Black community. And there's a lot of those agencies out here again. Let me try to upload that part of the show, and I'll go from there. But let's go on and finish the show off and kick it with Frederick Douglass, 347-838-9825.
Follow, follow, follow the drinking bowl.
Mercy, mercy.
The day dawns. The morning star is bright upon the horizon. The iron gate of our prison stands half open. One gallant rush from the north will fling it wide open. While 4 millions of our brothers and sisters shall march out into liberty. Frederick Douglass, 1863.
In the Civil War between the North and South, Frederick Douglass was not a soldier, not a politician.
Yet he is a major figure in the coming of the Civil War and in the way the Civil War is fought. I think it's fair to say that in many ways he's the conscience of the nation in this instance, because he keeps before it this idea that this is a war not just to bring the nation back together, but it's a war to end this awful system, slavery, and it's a war to bring equality to Black people, to make them part of American society.
I think he's sort of the image of a pillar of strength. If you had to pick someone, a tower of strength, just the strength emanates from him. And his hair, he's sometimes been characterized as the Lion of Anacostia.
People who described his speaking style and seeing and hearing him speak talk about the kind of power. He had a deep baritone, rich toned voice.
Frederick Douglass was certainly very striking as to his appearance. An aquiline nose, very piercing, wide set eyes, a very strong chin. And he was a tall man, about 6 feet 2 inches, broad-shouldered, muscular, a man who
in fact, attempted to maintain himself in a strong and forceful appearance.
Douglas's life sort of stands across the expanse of the 19th century as a symbol of the worst and the best in the American character. He was the slave who saw most of the worst brutalities of slavery. He was the slave, however, who freed himself and by luck, pluck, and gifts remade himself. Most importantly, he had an enormous ability to capture in words the meaning of what America is about.
I have no accurate knowledge of my age, never having seen any authentic record containing it. By far the larger part of the slaves know as little of their ages as horses know of theirs, and it is the wish of most masters within my knowledge to keep their slaves thus ignorant. I do not remember to have ever met a slave who could tell of his birthday. Frederick Douglass, 1845.
It was along the eastern shore of Maryland, near a quiet creek called the Tuckahoe, that the life of the man who would inspire a nation began.
Frederick Douglass was born in Talbot County on Maryland's eastern shore. He wasn't certain of his birth himself. In fact, he thought that he had been born in 1817.
But slave records tell of the birth of Frederick Augustus to a slave named Harriet in February 1818.
He knew who his mother was, although she was a distant figure in his life. She lived on another plantation. He never really knew who his father was, although he came to believe that his father was definitely a white man and probably his master.
His master, Aaron Anthony, lived in the large white house that stood at the entrance to the plantation. It was part of a group of farms owned by a man known as Colonel Edward Lloyd.
Edward Lloyd's plantation was quite large, especially by Maryland standards. Maryland was an upper south state where generally you didn't have large numbers of slaves like the massive plantations that you might have expected in some areas of the deep south.
Raised by his grandmother at the far end of the plantation, the tiny boy named Frederick led a carefree, playful life along the muddy shores of the Tuckahoe until he was six.
At about age six, Douglas found that his childhood had come to an abrupt end. He was assigned to act as the companion and caretaker of the child of the owner of the plantation. And as a result, he could get in trouble for things that he either had done or had failed to do. And so it became immediately apparent that he was no longer a child but was a slave and was part of that institution of slavery.
Slavery's basic premise was that black people were inferior and were here to do the heavy work so that the superior whites could spend their time doing more important things. Slavery was an institution where one human being had absolute control over another human being. They might be here tomorrow, they might be sold the next day.
It was, in many ways, hopelessness condensed. They could not control where they went, what they did, what they ate, who they could marry, or even how they would conduct their religious lives. And so for many of these folks, it was truly just a step above the grave.
Into this inhuman system, slavery, young Frederick quickly came of age at the Lloyd plantation.
Shortly after arriving there, he witnessed the brutal beating of an aunt of his Aunt Hester. She had actually been beaten by Aaron Anthony, his owner, because she had disobeyed him. And so she was strung up and brutally lashed by him. And Douglas was witness to that.
Her arms were stretched up at their full length so that she stood upon the ends of her toes. He then said to her, "I'll learn you how to disobey my orders." And soon the warm red blood came dripping to the floor. Frederick Douglass, 1845.
It must have been terribly dehumanizing. On the one hand, Douglass and slaves like him were aware that there were free people of color and wondered certainly how that could be, why it was that there were some people who were free and some people who remained slaves, like he and his grandmother and his other relatives. And when you had free people in the midst of slaves in that way, it certainly did make the slaves long for freedom even more.
I've often been utterly astonished to hear persons who speak of the singing of a slave as evidence of his contentment and happiness. This is a terrible mistake. The songs of a slave represent the sorrows of his heart. Frederick Douglass. Freedom. Young Frederick would discover his pathway to liberty after he was moved to the plantation owned by Hugh Auld, where he learned to read.
The fact that Frederick Douglass learned how to read at all is amazing, because in slavery, slaves were not supposed to learn how to read. It turned out that his mistress taught him how to read, despite the fact her own husband was not happy with the fact that she was doing that.
She treated him as if he were an adopted child. And one of the things she did was, I think she was having trouble learning to read herself, but she was struggling to learn to read the Bible, and she taught him to read the Bible. He then, in his childhood, tricked his white childhood acquaintances into sharing their homework and their books with him, which was not something that would be accepted officially, but between kids, nobody ever thought much about it.
From that moment, I understood the pathway from slavery to freedom. It was just what I wanted, and I got it at a time when I least expected it. Frederick Douglass, 1845. At age 15, the slave Frederick Douglass was moved across the Chesapeake Bay to become a laborer. No longer isolated on a plantation, he would get a view of urban life in Baltimore. I've sat on Kenner's Wharf at the foot of Philpott Street in Baltimore, and I've seen men and women chained and put on a ship to go to New Orleans, and I still hear their cries. Frederick Douglass, 1845.
In Baltimore, Douglass was hired on to a slave job in a shipyard, where he learned the skill and trade of a ship's caulker.
When Frederick Douglass got a job in the shipyard in Baltimore, he was still a slave, but he was an urban slave. That is, he was rented out to someone who then paid him for his work.
Allowed to keep a portion of his shipyard wages, Frederick eagerly saved to buy his first book.
The first book that Frederick Douglass read was The Columbian Orator. And it's not really accurate to say he read it. He memorized it. He practiced it. These were a collection of famous speeches, and as he read them, he'd read them over and over again, and then he would practice them. He would practice the tone of voice. He would practice the way he was to deliver these speeches.
In Baltimore, Douglass finds a community of free blacks. He finds religious institutions. He finds friends and perhaps even mentors in the black community, and a sense of social identity. And this will serve him well in later life.
It was at this time that Douglass would court a free black woman named Anna Murray.
Anna Murray was a pious, very quiet, very supportive African-American woman. It is quite obvious why Douglas was attracted to her. She gave him the support that he was looking for. She encouraged him in his efforts to acquire his freedom.
There were many schemes that slaves employed to acquire their freedom in the North. Henry Brown mailed himself to Philadelphia in a box. Still other slaves found freedom by becoming passengers on the Underground Railroad.
The Underground Railroad, despite the sound of the word, is not really a railroad that runs underground. What it was a series of places, houses, barns, sheds, tunnels, caves, just all sorts of places at strategic distances from slave territory into the North, where runaway slaves were hidden by a variety of people, black people and white people.
Harriet Tubman was the most famous and most wonderful of the operators on the Underground Railroad, a former slave who would have been very severely punished if she'd been caught.
Harriet Tubman was truly working on the front lines. Harriet Tubman took a direct and personal involvement in the efforts of achieving African-American freedom. She literally went back into slave territory and personally led slaves out on the Underground Railroad or through whatever means were possible in helping them to achieve their freedom.
Frederick Douglass would someday meet and admire Harriet Tubman, but not before he escaped on his own.
In 1838, Douglass devises a plan with Anna Murray to escape to the North. She sells a poster bed and gives him money to aid in the escape.
He has papers that will allow him to pass for a sailor, and sailors traveled regularly, and there were considerable numbers at that time of black sailors. So he's able to go by train to Wilmington, Delaware, still an area where he could be returned as a slave, and takes a steamboat for Philadelphia. In Pennsylvania, he is in a free state.
He continued to New York and was joined there by Anna Murray. They were married and resumed the journey north to New Bedford in Massachusetts. This whaling port held the bright promise of freedom for Douglass and his new bride.
When Douglass arrives in New Bedford, Massachusetts, one of the first things if he attempts to do is find work. And he is, after all, a ship caulker. He had done that in Baltimore. New Bedford is a place where they build ships.
But even in Massachusetts, he finds that racism will rear its ugly head. And there are white laborers who will not work alongside of a black ship's caulker. And so even though he is trained and skilled in this particular endeavor, he has to take a job as a common laborer, cutting wood and doing other kinds of odd jobs in an attempt to make enough money to survive.
But finding work wasn't all that concerned Douglass in Massachusetts.
Douglass isn't safe in New Bedford for another important reason. He's still a slave. He's a runaway slave. He's a fugitive slave. And in the United States at that time, a fugitive slave, if found out, if captured, could be returned to slavery no matter how long he stayed in the place of his escape.
Within months of his arrival in New Bedford, Douglass learned of the abolition movement.
William Lloyd Garrison was perhaps the most prominent of the abolitionists of that period, and he was one of the group known as immediatists. These were abolitionists who wanted slavery to end immediately.
On the subject of slavery, I do not wish to think or speak or write with moderation. Tell a man whose house is on fire to give moderate alarm. Tell him to moderately rescue his wife from the hands of a ravisher. But urge me not to use moderation in a cause like the present. I will not retreat a single inch, and I will be heard. William Lloyd Garrison, 1831.
Douglass becomes interested in abolitionism. He He becomes interested in the newspaper published by William Lloyd Garrison called The Liberator, and becomes aware of the network of abolitionists that exist throughout the northeastern states.
The Liberator became my meat and my drink. My soul was set all on fire. Its sympathy for my brethren in bonds, its faithful exposures of slavery, and its powerful attacks upon the institution sent a thrill of joy through my soul such as I had never felt before. Frederick Douglass, 1845. Grand anti-slavery convention was held in Nantucket under the auspices of Mr. Garrison and his friends. I had taken no holiday since establishing myself in New Bedford, and I determined on attending the meeting. Frederick Douglass.
The summer of 1841 saw Frederick Douglass steam away through the coastal waters of New Bedford. He called it his holiday. But as he crossed the water, he journeyed to a new beginning on the island of Nantucket.
Douglass will attend a meeting of the American Anti-Slavery Society, and Garrison speaks. Douglass is electrified. Garrison learns that an escaped slave is in the crowd and asks Douglass to stand up and say a few words.
Men and women are in a semicircle on the podium. And Douglass stands up at the lectern and begins his talk. And quietly, the voice begins. And he tells stories about having been a slave, what slave life was like. And for 2 hours, the audience will be just hanging on every word, just a huge crowd. And he will work that crowd like a preacher.
I stand before you this night as a thief. And a robber. I stole this head, these limbs, this body from my master and ran off with them. I have seen this pious man cross and tie the hands of a young female slave and lash her on the bare skin and justify the deed with a quotation from the Bible.
Frederick Douglass becomes an overnight success in this arena of public speaking in the anti-slavery cause, not at the beginning because of his oratorical powers, but because here is the genuine article. Here is a man who was himself a slave.
The public have itching ears to hear a colored man speak, and particularly a slave. Multitudes will flock to hear one of his class speak. It would be good policy to employ a number of colored agents, if suitable ones can be found. John Collins, Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society, 1842.
Garrison, too, was impressed with Douglass and determined that Douglass could be of enormous help to the anti-slavery cause. And so, fairly soon thereafter, Douglass is recruited to go about the country and lecture on behalf of the Anti-Slavery Society.
By 1843, Douglass had embarked with Garrison on the 100 Conventions Project, a six-month tour of anti-slavery meetings in New England, Ohio, Illinois, and Indiana. As an abolitionist speaker, Douglass was regularly singled out for attack by pro-slavery supporters. Still, the great speaker would evolve into a persuasive writer.
Douglass publishes his first biography, Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, in 1845. In that autobiography, he does give details. He gives information about his owners. He talks about the area from which he had escaped. And he does so at great risk to himself. He knows that now the owner does know where he is and certainly could send a slave catcher to get him.
In order to protect himself, in fact, he goes to England. and he stays in England for almost 2 years because he indeed believes, and others believe, that he will be taken back into slavery.
While in England, friends of his collect money for his purchase, and they make arrangements with his owner to have him sold to them, of course, and Douglas gets his freedom that way.
In 1847, Douglas returned to the United States, not as a fugitive slave, but as a free man.
On his return from England, Frederick Douglass moves to Rochester, New York, and begins to publish a newspaper, the North Star.
The symbolism, of course, of the North Star was what the slave escaping to freedom followed as he fled northward toward what he hoped would be a better life. And Douglass wanted his newspaper to be part of that process toward a better life for all black people.
It's also at this very time in the late 1840s and early 1850s that Douglass was really experiencing a kind of political awakening as well. He was beginning to learn the art of politics, even though, like all black leaders before the Civil War, he would never have elective sanction.
In July of 1852, the people of Rochester invited Douglass to address their Independence Day festivities. For Douglass, this was not a day to celebrate.
The character and conduct of this nation never looked blacker to me than on this 4th of July. To drag a man in fetters into the grand illuminated Temple of Liberty and call upon him to join you in joyous anthems are inhuman mockery. My subject, fellow citizens, is American slavery. This 4th of July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice. I must mourn. Frederick Douglass, 1852.
The 1850s saw Frederick Douglass continue a comfortable home life in Rochester, New York. He and Anna would raise 5 children here, among them Charles and Rosetta. With their help, he would continue his newspaper, now called Frederick Douglass's Paper. It was also in Rochester that he would meet a man called Brown.
John Brown was an abolitionist who was absolutely dedicated to the overthrow of the institution of slavery.
John Brown said that slavery could be purged only by blood. It could be overthrown only by force. And by the middle 1850s, Douglass was open to this message.
John Brown and Douglass established a very close relationship because John Brown shared the mission that Douglass did. John Brown was a white man who felt that it was immoral to hold slaves and was determined that he would do whatever was necessary to free them and, if necessary, lead the slaves in insurrection.
John Brown had indeed planned such a revolt at a place called Harper's Ferry in Virginia.
When Brown begins to develop his plan for the attack on Harper's Ferry, he wants Frederick Douglass to participate in it. Douglass thinks about it for some time, but he decides this is not for him. He decides not to do it.
As a result of the raid, John Brown and his men were hung for treason. To Douglass, Brown had become a powerful symbol for the violent overthrow of the slave system.
Posterity will owe everlasting thanks to John Brown. Slavery is a system of brute force. It must be met with its own weapons. John Brown has initiated a new mode of carrying on the crusade of freedom. Frederick Douglass, 1859.
By 1860, the sectional dispute symbolized by men like John Brown had reached grand proportions. and the Republican, Abraham Lincoln, would run for president of a divided nation.
Now, Abraham Lincoln, as the presidential candidate, has made some pretty non-committal kinds of remarks regarding slavery. But at the same time, the subtext is clearly to at least restrain slavery to the areas where it exists now, and perhaps if you squinted a little, you could see Lincoln looking down the road toward perhaps reducing the power of slavery.
If he's elected president, the South is in dire difficulty. So as a result of Lincoln's election, the South decides to take the fatal move to secede from the Union, because they're sure that down the road, slavery is in dire peril.
On April 12, 1861, Confederate troops bombarded Fort Sumter, a federal installation in the harbor of Charleston, South Carolina.
When the first rebel cannon shattered the walls of Sumter and drove away its starving garrison, I predicted that the war then and there would not be fought entirely by white men. The chance is now given you to end in a day the bondage of centuries, and to rise in one bound from social degradation to the place of common equality with all other varieties of men. Frederick Douglass.
Well, once the Civil War came, to Frederick Douglass it was unmistakable. This war had been caused by slavery, and its purpose ought to be the abolition of slavery. He saw Fort Sumter and the outbreak of war as more than reason for the federal government to commit itself to a war against slavery. At least that's what he most fondly hoped.
Douglass is glad to see the war come. He knows that it means the freedom of millions of slaves in the South and a changed way of life for thousands of free blacks in the North. Douglass argues, lectures, writes, proposes constantly that there should be a Negro army. These comments fall on deaf ears. The War Department has no interest in recruiting black soldiers.
By refusing to let blacks fight in the Union armies, the North was depriving itself of thousands of willing and able soldiers. And the casualties that the Northern armies faced on the battlefield would become alarming. September 17, 1862, saw the worst day of fighting to date, as the U.S. Army of the Potomac and the Confederate Army of Northern Virginia faced off along Antietam Creek in Sharpsburg, Maryland. The Union lost 12,000 soldiers.
In 1862, after the Battle of Antietam, it is clear that this is going to be a long and bloody and difficult war. Lincoln uses Antietam as an opportunity to announce his upcoming Emancipation Proclamation.
Whereas, on the 22nd day of September, A.D. 1862, all persons held as slaves within any state or designated part of a state shall be then, thenceforward, and forever free. And the executive government of the United States, including the military and naval authority thereof, will recognize and maintain the freedom of such persons. President Abraham Lincoln, 1862.
One of the provisions in the Emancipation Proclamation was that African Americans could be enlisted to help win this war in any way that the administration thought they could be useful, including as soldiers.
Douglass is, of course, wildly enthusiastic about this. And in 1863, Douglass is approached by George L. Stearns, a Massachusetts philanthropist and businessman who has been appointed to recruit a regiment of African-American soldiers for the Civil War, and Douglass becomes one of his recruiting officers.
I hereby authorize Frederick Douglass to go to Washington, D.C. as my agent to transact business connected with the recruiting service for United States Colored Volunteers. Major George L. Stearns, August 1863.
Douglas meets with Lincoln at the White House in August of 1863, and they had an immensely respectful meeting. And frankly, Douglas came away from that, as he once said in simple terms, "I felt big there." Douglas came away with a certain respect for Lincoln's intentions, if not a total respect for his policies.
In churches and meeting halls across the North, Douglas spoke to crowds of young black men, convincing them to put on the uniform of the Union.
From east to west, from north to south, the sky is written all over, now or never. I urge you to fly to arms and smite with death the power that would bury the government and your liberty in the same hopeless grave. He who would be free themselves must strike the blow. Frederick Douglass, March 2nd, 1863.
He goes out and heavily recruits blacks for particularly the 54th. Massachusetts, an all-black unit with white officers.
Two of Douglas's first recruits to the 54th Massachusetts were his sons, Charles Reman Douglas and Lewis Douglas, who would become Sergeant Major.
One of the outstanding examples of black soldiers fighting in the Civil War was the 54th Massachusetts leading of the assault on Fort Wagner, one of the outposts defending Charleston Harbor in July of 1863. Robert Gould Shaw, who was the white Massachusetts colonel of the 54th Massachusetts Regiment, had been pleading for an opportunity to prove that his men would fight, to prove their courage. And he got his wish when the commander assigned the 54th to lead the attack. They did so. They fought heroically. They suffered almost 50% casualties, including Colonel Shaw.
This regiment has established its reputation as a fighting regiment. Not a man flinched, though it was a trying time. I've been in two fights and am unhurt. The last was desperate, and we charged that terrible battery on Morris Island, known as Fort Wagner. Men fell all around me. How I got out of that fight alive, I cannot tell. Sergeant Lewis Douglas, 1863.
Douglas's role in the Civil War, in the victory in the Civil War, is important. The very fact that by the end of the war, some 200,000 black soldiers and sailors participated in the war, about a tenth of the entire Union force during this war, is very, very important. One could argue that they were pivotal as the war was coming to an end.
I end where I begin. No war but an abolition war. No peace but an abolition peace. Liberty for all. Chains for none. Frederick Douglass, 1864.
We'll make the rebels stand by the Union.
Standing in solitary grace in the hills above Washington, D.C., stands a stately home called Cedar Hill. It was here, far from the plantation where he was born in slavery, that Frederick Douglass would spend his final years.
What's interesting about the house is that it's a large house, 14 rooms. It has a white columned porch, and it is an estate. Looking out over the Anacostia River at the Capitol, it is very reminiscent of the houses lived in by slave owners years before. And so Douglas has his sort of ironic place in the sun in a setting that is very much representative of a Victorian gentleman.
By the end of the war, Douglas is seen as a leader of black America. He's a fairly wealthy man. He is able to purchase a fine home, but he's still not satisfied. Douglas, to the end of his life, was looking for greater things. He wanted some governmental appointment, and eventually he did acquire those. He was made Marshal of the District of Columbia.
He spoke at anniversary after anniversary, at GAR reunion after GAR reunion, down to the 1890s, where he tried to forge a kind of black abolitionist memory of the Civil War, increasingly losing that struggle against the sentimentalized, romanticized, lost cause conception of the meaning and memory of the Civil War. But to his dying day, Douglass insisted that what this war had been about was not just a fight between men of valor, but a struggle to establish, as he once said, a nation that could live up to its creeds.
The winter of 1882 saw Douglass publish his last autobiography. In the summer, he watched as Anna, his wife, passed away.
He grieved terribly. He really seems almost to have had a nervous breakdown in that following summer. But he pulled himself together, largely through being involved in reform things. And one of the movements that he was very committed to was equal rights for women.
Douglass never retired from public view in Washington. His lecture fee was now $150 plus expenses, and he remained in constant demand.
About 17 months or so after the death of his first wife, to whom he'd been married for 44 years, Douglass decides to again take up matrimony. He marries a woman that he has had working in his office. Helen Pitts was nearly 20 years younger than Frederick Douglass and was white. When Douglass married her in 1884, this caused a tremendous sensation in the United States.
One of the things that Douglass encountered in that new relationship was a realization that despite being the great Frederick Douglass, he was still another black man stepping across the bounds of American society's mores. If Douglass thought that he had overcome, or that America had overcome its own prejudices, his second marriage, as nothing else, brought that reality closer home to Douglass.
It could be certain, however, that well into his 71st year, Frederick Douglass would not be stopped by bigotry.
Late in his life, President Benjamin Harrison, a Republican, recognized Douglass in an interesting way and made him minister to Haiti, the Black Republic.
Putting him out there as a representative of America, I think in many ways was a crowning part of his career.
It was a career that in many ways was a miracle. Born a slave, he stood in his closing days as a statesman. On February 20th, 1895, Frederick Douglass suffered a stroke at his home on Cedar Hill and was dead at the age of 78.
What happens next is a solemn and somber awareness of Douglass's passing throughout the United States. African Americans throughout the country hear, as soon as the telegraph and the railroads and other means can allow it to be known.
If Frederick Douglass's great voice had been silenced, it had, before he died, been heard.
Slavery is a doomed system.
Slavery was over. But more than that, he had insisted always that African Americans must have full equality. He never wavered from that.
To those who have suffered in slavery, I can say I too have suffered. To those who have battled for liberty, brotherhood, and citizenship, I can say I too have battled. Frederick Douglass.
Yeah, that was Frederick Douglass. What more can I say? Black History Month, everybody. Coming up next, the Jacksons.
Made for all men. walked in the court, her knees buckled, saying for a man to survive, he need hustle. Seen and been through struggle her whole life, made the transition from being his hoe to his wife. Stifling, the night had been the ATF busting. Her daddy was a hustler, so she loved him. Looked at the jury, how can they judge him? She screamed. In her chest, her face with tears, had a man's back, he was facing years, in her name, though the place was his, they trying to take everything except the kids, for years she been through scuffle and fights, while he trying to hustle that white, up all night, wondering if he's alive, seeing him try, she bubbled inside and screamed. Judge yelled for order, court reporter making her words shorter. His lawyer sat next to him. She could see how the trial was affecting him. It hurt for her eyes to connect with him. Using her lies for protecting him. They arrested him for murder and gun possession. As they read back her confession, she screamed. The foreman got the verdict from the bailiff. Emotional outbursts, tears, and smeared makeup. It stated he was guilty on all charges. She shaking, looking like she took it the hardest. A spin artist, she brought her face up laughing. That's when the prosecutor realized what happened. All that speaking of mind, testifying and crying. When this bitch did the crime, the queen pin.
Before you let my love away, before you lock my love away. Former Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. isn't the only member of the House getting looked at by the feds. According to one published report, the Chicago Sun-Times, citing sources, reported Monday that the federal investigators are also taking an independent look at former Chicago Alderman Sandy Tell No Lies Jackson. Reports that the Sun-Times, Natasha Korinsky and Michael Sneed, included in the scrutiny of Sandy Jackson, who resigned from the 7th Ward automatic position last month, is her access and use of her husband's congressional campaign money, including credit card charges, as well as the movement of money from one account to another, sources said. Sandy Jackson acknowledged to NBC Chicago back in December that state officials had questioned her about a $69,000 discrepancy between her campaign finance reports and those of her husband. She blamed the conflict on clerical errors made by transitioning staff members and said amendments to her reports were being made. Y'all remember that? And now they're after her. Matter of fact, they was after her for, I think, fixing the house up. But you should read the article that they're dealing with on in the Sun-Times on the issue, because they deal with the Rolex watch. First they said it was for a female, then they said it was for a man. They don't know who it was. Did Sandy buy it for a boyfriend? Did Jesse buy it for his boyfriend? Everybody making speculations. Everybody making innuendos, but I'm not even going there. I'm not even going there. Where I'm going at is that now the perpetration of a fraud on the black community is coming to a head. And by the 14th, that's 2/14/2014, next year, We all see what's up. But let me flash back in time. Flash back in time for a second to when they were on HGTV, sitting back like the power couple they were, lovers and friends, Jesse and Sandy.
Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. has not been seen in Washington or Chicago since he checked out of a Mayo Clinic earlier this week as an inpatient. But tonight we get an inside look at the couple's Chicago home, which could be at the center of the federal probe, from what our sources are saying. Fox 32's Darlene Hill here now with some new information tonight. Darlene.
Yeah, Robin. The Jacksons went on HGTV a couple of years ago looking for some remodeling tips. The film crew goes all over the place, and at times the host of the show calls the basement on 72nd Street campaign headquarters. Tonight, my sources tell me that's a problem.
Sandy's obviously an elected official. I'm an elected official. So where our home is physically located is part of our joint jurisdiction.
That's what Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. told the host of a popular HGTV show in 2009 when the Jacksons decided it was time to redo their two-bedroom Chicago bungalow. Their budget, $250,000.
Jesse Jackson Jr. and his wife, Sandy, want to shake things up a bit. They love their career in politics and love their Chicago home, not to mention the place has become campaign central over the last several years.
We have some space that would normally be a wonderful family space that just houses computers.
This computer room is called the War Room. There are a number of TVs, printers, and copying machines here in the basement. Sophisticated equipment. Once a letter is typed, it's sorted, stacked, and a stamp is put on it. My sources say this area of the Jackson Chicago home may be part of the federal investigation. He's accused of spending $20,000 to renovate the space and buy furniture for it. His wife, Alderman Sandy Jackson, is a consultant for his campaign operation, and the Wall Street Journal now says that she's under federal investigation.
Are Jesse and Sandy going to take control and move campaign headquarters off property?
The host of Hidden Potential, Brandy Millay, gave the Jacksons a few ideas.
Let's see if Jesse and Sandy can agree on the basement renovation.
And no more war room down here.
Wow! How much is something like this going to cost?
What we looked at, we're talking between $30,000 and $50,000.
Oh, that's not bad.
At the end of the show, again, it was taped in 2009. The Jacksons decided not to renovate the basement of their South Shore bungalow. The congressman and his wife, Sandy, have denied any wrongdoing, and tonight again, my source tells me that she is not being investigated. So, of course, the federal investigation continues.
That show might be investigating now.
Yeah. Sophisticated stuff down there. Yeah. Ideas, but they never went through with him as far as the show knows.
Right. All right. Exactly. Thank you, Darlene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was when they had the love affair with the Jacksons. But we know she's getting investigated now. Let me tell you. The pressure's getting to the father. Now, my sources tell me that the Jackson family are upset with Sandy. Now, let's be following that. Follow that story in the next tabloids to come up pretty soon. But check out Jesse Jackson Sr. He's trying to bait the president to come to Chicago for this girl's funeral. Now, I'm not saying this girl's not worthy of having a president here, but they're playing games. They're playing games. And this girl definitely should not be taken political. But let's just hear how Jesse Jackson, trying to be big bad Jesse, goes on WLS this morning.
Now, Bruce Wolf and Dan Prost.
Dan Prost, and we are joined in the studio right now by the Reverend Jesse Jackson. Thank you for coming in, Reverend Jackson. We appreciate it.
Good morning, sir.
So we would like at another time to talk about your experience at the Super Bowl over the weekend. You were there during the black.
The lights went out.
Yeah, lights went out. But your part was lit, so you were just fine, right?
Well, it was a very fun occasion. There's nothing quite like the Super Bowl. I mean, people have such a spirit and embracing each other. And it's a joyous experience.
Well, and something a little bit
the
more.
The fans were missing, and so I was kind of, I didn't really have a hound in the hunt. I was looking at the Ravens, looking at San Francisco. I wish the Bears had been there.
Yeah, most Bear fans would have not gone to the game, but you do what you want to do.
On a more serious note, though, what you're making news on this week is, one, calling on the president to come back home and speak to the the systemic issue of gun violence.
The magnitude of the problem here, you know, 516 killed last year, 175 on age 18. This year, more than 45, more than killing a day. There is a crisis. His presence would give us a kind of an assurance that children are traumatized. They are afraid to go to school. They cannot study with attention spans very short in school. They're afraid to come home from school. There's no recess at school. They can't do outdoor recreation. They need a kind of assurance. Also, there's such fear. Half of these murders have not been solved. They don't know who did the killing. The guy who killed Mayor Daley's bodyguard, they've not yet arrested the person. And it means that somebody's providing sanctuary for killers, but they're afraid of protection, lack of protection witness. Lack of protection witness, so people are afraid to talk. So there's an abounding fear that that cycle needs to be broken.
But you're calling for the federal government to come in right now and patrol the streets. It's either the National Guard or the Department of Homeland Security. It's federalizing the police force.
Well, in some sense, it's beyond the domain of the mayor. I think has done a good job. I think he's working very diligently, and I think so is McCarthy. But Chicago doesn't have a gun shop. The guns are coming in from Barrington and from Rock Island and the surrounding states. Guns are coming in. We can't stop that. Drugs are coming in from across the border, and jobs are leaving. And of 77 communities in Chicago, about 21 of these killings are taking place. 21. Unemployment is about 45%. And so this is a bound, this is a zone of poverty and pain and death, and we need real help.
Well, so, there's other urban centers in this country, New York, L.A., Detroit, 300 million guns in circulation in this country. So there's guns in circulation moving all across the country. There's drugs in circulation moving all across the country. Chicago's murder rate is three times what New York is, what L.A. is per capita. So how can you, on the one hand, say we have this problem here, but that other communities, other urban centers don't have, at least certainly not anywhere near the extent, but they're doing a good job?
Well, it's really the murder rate in New Orleans is off the hook. The murder rate in Baltimore, we have an urban crisis. And right now, for the most part, it's jobs out, guns and drugs in. We need an urban policy. I need some plan for reconstruction. And I'm concerned that this 45% unemployment rate is substantial. Also, these areas, based women requires the banks targeted, student clustered, and took people's homes. And the homes went, and windows were replaced with boards, and the tax base went down, the education went down, the local cleaners and local stores cannot be serviced. So these are zones of poverty and pain. And there must be some plan for support.
Here's the problem, though.
All right.
I mean, you know, we've got a couple of minutes here. But it's, you're always calling for federal solutions to things. When it's the federal solutions that exacerbate the problems, and that's why you've got Roseland 20% unemployment.
At a certain point in Birmingham, we had to ask for the feds to intervene because the locals could not do it.
But this is not 1957 anymore, Reverend Jackson.
I mean, when they had the hurricane Sandy in New York, and the jury had to get federal intervention. Locals could not pull it. The impact of Newtown drew federal attention because that's what triggered the whole gun investigation, gun law change.
And you think we're going to prevent Newtowns by we're not even going to ban AK-47s. The president, who you want here, isn't even going to ban AK-47s.
It's enough to shot an AK-47 in the White House 2 years ago. The fact is we're living in a real zone of danger, and we really do need help. And I think the highest level of Chicago, because of the sheer magnitude of this problem, deserves and needs is help.
Should
we need help me out over half now?
Should we go back to the handgun? I mean, setting aside the recent string of court cases, should we go back to the handgun ban that we used?
I'm going to pause it right there. Let me see if I can run that track back just a little bit. Is Jesse threatening the president because he said an AK-47 shot at the president, so he should ban him? Hold on, let me run this back. Just don't trip on me, everybody. Don't trip on the message. Let me see if I can get that run. See if I can run that back. I might have went back too far. Forgive me, everybody.
And that's why you've got Roseland 20% unemployment.
At a certain point in Birmingham, we had to ask for the feds to intervene because the locals could not do it.
But this is not 1957 anymore, Reverend Jackson.
I mean, when they had the hurricane Sandy in New York, and the jury had to get federal intervention, locals could not pull it. the impact of Newtown drew federal attention because that's what triggered the whole gun investigation, gun law change.
And you think we're going to prevent Newtowns by we're not even going to ban AK-47s. The president, who you want here, isn't even going to ban AK-47s.
This is enough to shot an AK Flushing in the White House 2 years ago.
Why had to mention that? What? Why is that important? Let me go and finish the story. See, I think Jesse has lost it. The pressure's gotten to Jesse. The pressure's strictly got to Jesse. You know? In a minute, somebody going to tell him to go sit down somewhere. It's not going to be me, but in a minute, somebody going to tell him to go sit at his black desk somewhere, go sit down somewhere.
The fact is, we're living in a real zone of danger. We really do need help, and I think the highest level of Chicago, because of the sheer magnitude of this problem, deserves and needs his help.
Should
we help on what we have now?
Should we go back to the handgun? I mean, setting aside the recent string of court cases, should we go back to the handgun ban that we used to have?
Well, for me, you know, one gun is too many, but that's not the point. If you want a gun for your house for protection, you've got that. But you're more likely to kill a rebel than a robber, or gone for hunting.
What about law-abiding citizens in the black neighborhoods
getting them? Whatever the color is, but these weapons are military style. They can not only blow up theaters and schools, they can blow airplanes.
Now, there he goes again. It don't matter what color. But right now, there are a lot of blacks getting killed for a shit matter what color. This is what I'm saying. Once upon a time, he cared about black people. Listen, the rainbow, Mr. Jackson, the Rainbow Coalition is taking care of the women getting theirs, the homosexuals are getting theirs, the Hispanics are getting theirs, the immigrants are getting theirs. Now, can the black folks get theirs, Jesse? Let me just play a little bit more. I'm sorry. I should let it flow without no commentary. I apologize.
These are threats.
How many airplanes have been blown up?
Well, I don't know. I think it was in the White House 2 years ago. The fact is, we're living in a real zone of danger. We really do need help. And I think the highest level of Chicago, because of the sheer magnitude of this problem, deserves and needs his help.
Should
we help me out with what we have now?
Should we go back to the handgun? I mean, setting aside the recent string of court cases, should we go back to the handgun ban that we used to have?
Well, for me, you know, one gun is too many, but that's not the point. If you want a gun for your house for protection, you've got that. But you're more likely to kill a rebel than a robber, or gone for hunting.
What about law-abiding citizens in the black neighborhoods getting them?
Whatever the color is, but these weapons are military style. They can not only blow up theaters and schools, they can blow airplanes. I mean, these are threats to
national. How many airplanes have been blown up?
Well, I don't want to.
We got a problem in the neighborhoods right now.
I don't want to tempt somebody to try it, but they sure have the power to do so. And that is what is frightening. Why should we have to be here on an after fact when we know these weapons? What function do they have? What function do these semi military style weapons have? Well, to kill people in mass. And
well, they're simply providing a distraction.
If what you said is true, that you're more likely to shoot yourself than an intruder, then why don't we give guns to criminals?
That's what happened.
Well, we have a little bit of that. My point is that the handgun, even in the house, the evidence of suicide and shooting relatives is much greater than shooting robbers, for example. That's the fact.
500 people that were killed were not suicide.
If you want the gun in your house, you got it. The gun behind it, you got it. There's no problem with that. The issue is these military-style weapons, which are so life-threatening, and there's no defense against them. Now, whether it is Arizona, where Congressman Gifford was shot and Red Friends were killed, or whether it's Aurora, Colorado, or NIU, or Virginia Tech, at some point it seems to me enough is enough of these killings.
And the crime rates are lower where people are allowed to carry weapons.
Not necessarily. So Newtown is a gun town, but I think comparing
Newtown is a gun town because they have gun ranges.
Well, they have more than that. They are really hound the guns, and the guns that make them less secure. For 32,000 Americans killed a year, 32,000 killed a year, 100,000 injured, we don't die. We are the most violent nation on earth. We kill them.
Now I'm gonna stop that for a second because I don't know if he's getting frustrated or not. I'm going to rewind it back again, let you check it out. But he says that more people kill themselves in their own house with guns
than criminals do. See, the pressure's getting to them.
The pressure is getting to them. Pressurized. I have no idea what's wrong with this man. I went back a little bit farther. Bear with me, man, because I just got to hear it again. I just got to hear it again.
To shoot yourself than an intruder, then why don't we give guns to criminals?
That's not the point. If you want a gun for your house for protection, you've got that. But you're more likely to kill a relative than a robber or a gun for hunting.
What about law-abiding citizens in the black neighborhood getting
them? But whatever the color is, but these are weapons are
military. Whatever the color is.
They can not only blow up feeders and schools, they can blow airplanes. I mean, these are threats to
national
security.
How many airplanes have been blown up?
Well, I don't want to.
We got a problem in the neighborhoods right now.
I don't want to tempt somebody to try it, but they should have the power to do so, and that is what is frightening. Why should we have to be here on an after fact when we know these weapons? What function do they have? What function do these semi-military style weapons have except to kill people in mass?
Well, they're certainly providing a distraction.
If what you said is true, that you're more likely to shoot yourself than an intruder, then why don't we give guns to criminals?
Well, we have a way of getting them. My point is that the handgun, even in the house, the evidence of suicide and shooting relatives is much greater than shooting robbers, for example. That's the fact.
The 500 people that were killed were not suicide.
If you want the gun in your house, you got it. The gun for hunting, you got it. There's no problem with that. The issue is these military-style weapons, which are so life-threatening, and there's no defense against them. Now, whether it is Arizona, where Congressman Gifford was shot, whether friends were killed, or whether it's Aurora, Colorado, or NIU, or Virginia Tech, at some point it seems to me enough is it.
You see, there he goes. Why are you trying to bring the tear jerking down in the community that are already taking care of theirs, Reverend Jackson? The people in our neighborhoods are suffering, Reverend Jackson. If you truly are a disciple of King Reverend Jackson, you'll concentrate on the people that are ailing, the people that come to your church every Saturday, and the Gabby Giffords, and the Arizona States. It's the Leroys, the Lydias, the Medeas, the Melvins and the little Janets and Jethros. I got a couple more seconds to play with this. I'm sorry again. No more commentary because I'm let it run. I got callers holding on.
And the crime rates are lower where people are allowed to carry weapons.
Not necessarily. So these,
yes, necessarily.
Newtown is a gun town, but I think comparing
Newtown is a gun town because they have gun ranges.
Well, they have more than that. They are really high on the guns, and the guns have made them less. 32,000 Americans killed a year. 32,000 killed a year. 100,000 injured. We're gonna die. We are the most violent nation on earth. We kill the most of each other. We lost less than 6,000 soldiers in Iraq in 10 years. 32,000 of us have killed each other a year. That suggests something very sick and very threatening.
Well, let's confiscate all the guns. It'll take 100 years.
Well, so something, the other issues that you raise and in recent interviews talk about poverty, lack of education. What about the Chicago public school system and the quality of education that's being provided to the 400,000 children in their charge? What about opening up that system that has been a systemic failure for generations?
Well, it's interesting that the 106 schools do not have a library. Unemployed them are south of North Avenue. For most of these schools do not have a library, for example. Often do not have the technical equipment that they need. And without the tax base, because the real estate tax base funds our education, when the banks foreclose and drive people out of their homes, the tax base goes down, the people leave, the local stores close. So it's an urban crisis. I think it deserves the most bright spotlight America can put on it.
Reverend Jackson, can you come back some other time?
Be delighted to.
Thank you for coming in. I guess the ticket to the Super Bowl next time. All right.
And I hope it has a bay on it.
Yeah, there you go.
There you go.
99 WLS. He has took his eyes off the prize, Jesse. This song is for you, man. Get off everybody's background. Tend to your own backyard. Don't be trying to put water on Master House.
1, 2, 3, 4. Been a voice like hers again. Tomorrow's show, we're going to have my man, Ronnie S. We're going to talk about the controversy and the concussion of young athletes in the college, high school, grammar school level. My man, Ronnie S., plays interstate football, played high school and Pop Warner, so did my children. And he recruits kids now to go to college, not only for football, baseball, basketball, and all those other type of sports. And he tried to assist them in getting scholarships. We're going to have him on. He's going to talk about how he's handling parents when they ask him those questions. And he's going to talk about himself and how he sometimes feels the effects of those hits and how he tried to use himself as an example to, I guess, persuade parents. Hope I'm representing you right, Ronnie S. New Music Thursday, we got that popping off. Thank you all for listening. Oh, and we're also going to do Paul Robeson. Okay? We're going to do a special on Paul Robeson. Give a shout out to him. A great activist, a forgotten man. You know, dude was on top of his game. And then he gets branded communist because he wants little black children to go to school down south. Even his own frat threw him out. You know what I'm saying? Even the Alphas threw him out. Even his boys, Flint and them, just push Flint and Gina, push the nigga to the side. It was wild, man. But I'm going to give like a little brief bio on my man. And so I guess I can just go on out with venting and see if I can get that on, and we can just fade out right there, Ebony. This is Jim Lee's Underground Radio Network. Thank you for listening. I hope you're enjoying my little presentation of Black History Month. I'm sorry I couldn't get that FBI joint in. I'm going to get it in probably tomorrow if I can feed it in, but not definitely next week. And we're going to be having the Republican, hopefully the Republican 2nd Congressional District debate here live. I'm just trying to get some of my journalist friends to assist me. And next week, we might have it. This time next week, we should have Professor Ron Carter to discuss what's really going down here in Chicago politics. Well, this is Jimmy's Underground Radio Network. Talk to me Tuesday. Thank you for listening. Like I said, everybody, good night. May your God be with you. Take us out with UWAP. And let me give some Black Power rap music, some Black Panther shit.
Hey, let's go to McDonald's. You're going to work for me until I tell you to quit.
You don't own me, pig, and no motherfucker tells me when I can split.
Who the fuck do you think you're talking to?
I'm talking to you, redneck faggot.
Here I sit, eating Christmas dinner leftovers. Constantly toting bullshit on my shoulders. I'm frigid. Heart keeps getting colder. Solving the case, the truth is getting closer. Shit on these dudes on the bus to your Range Rover. Similar to Jigga on niggas, I take over. Mr. 4655, please move over. Always survive the floods of madness like Noah. White boy goose and your crew, a bunch of jokers. This goes for all of y'all, I'm hanging up wanted posters. Mad coy won't happen until if you get focused. Play the enemy and feel the wrath of Black Sosa. Fuck your best friend over the sofa. Bender over. Kids were sleeping, had to sneak out. Beautiful weekend. And if she was to call now, I would do it again. Violent bars, so please stop with the grins. You whispering niggas bleed milk like Sean Penn. Eyes to the sky like God, where have you been? They got kids, instead I kill them with a pen. Fuck all you bitter bitches who can't recognize real men. I'm bitten. A few names will be mentioned. If you cross that line, I will attack, no restrictions. Steven, I would have took you off this planet if it wasn't for your cousin. While all you young niggas wanna die trying to prove something. Bumbling niggas can't handle me. On 131, he created a masterpiece. I ask myself, why the fuck are y'all mad at me? Don't be surprised when I start speaking my piece. Kids, mama talking shit, wanna check her cavities. Nah, I won't do the penitentiary. I apologize for my people. Full of old money. Mayday, mayday, they burned down the cafe. Damn, these are the last days. Before I leave, I want my own show, Ray J. Can't do shit, nay, nay. Confused pretty bitches, you can get the payday. I'm so fly, Mr. O'Hare, midway. Learn from me, no replay to sensei. They're mad, cause I have kids now. Like dogs and strangers, bitch, get down. Just Mag and Millie, you motherfuckers are loud. Please, with both of y'all, put something in your mouth. I'm tired of the nonsense. This is free music. And no, it's not convict. Out like Mike Vick. Full-fledged lyricist. Complicated like pyramids. God damn it, y'all got me irritated. Any challenge in front of me, nigga, I will face it. And leave you looking stupid till they say go get a facelift.
Why do you do the things you do?
Good night, everybody. I'll see y'all tomorrow. Peace and may your God be with you always, because mine is with mine.